The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning. Welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I'm Gina Mastrangeli, a member of this fellowship, and looking out and seeing all of you this morning, it's really nice. As a community, we welcome each other here today. We're Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a caring community that aspires to empower people to grow spiritually, nurture one another, and work for justice and stewardship of the earth. So whoever you are, whether you're here today in the building or with us online, we welcome you, whoever you are, whatever your background, wherever you are in your spiritual journey. We welcome you into our circle of love and joy and compassion. We extend a special welcome to any visitors here today. Please let us know who you are. On Zoom, you're welcome to sign our online visitor card, which will be in chat. And then following the service, both online and in the fellowship, we invite you to our informal fellowship time so that we can get to know you. We have a special guest speaker, This morning is Michelle France. Is it Francel? Okay. A chemistry professor at Bryn Mawr College and an adjunct scholar at the Vatican Observatory. That means she belongs to both the world of science and religion. Her topic this morning is Impractically Practical, Are Scientists Mystics? And I'm just going to read her description. It's better than anything that I can paraphrase. We can think of science and contemplative practices such as meditation as sitting at opposite poles, one hard and objective, the other soft and subjective. Yet both are eminently grounded in the here and now, what is right in front of them. What, if anything, might mystics and monks have to offer scientists? What, if anything, might scientists have to offer them in return? What common ground is there between science and faith? What perspectives might one have that would enrich the other approach? So let us now open our service as we do every Sunday by lighting the chalice, the symbol of our liberal religious faith. Beth McGrain will lead us.
Good morning. We light the chalice with words from astronomer Maria Mitchell. The greatest benefit derived from the study of science is that it lifts you out and above the littleness of daily trials. We learn to live in the universe as part of it. We cannot separate ourselves from. Our every act connects us with it. Our every act affects the whole. Standing under the canopy of stars and remembering their presence, you could scarcely do a petty deed or think of a wicked thought.
Okay, as Beth lights the peace lamp, may peace be with you, be with us. Thank you. Okay, this morning, please let us sing together our gathering hymn, a favorite of my generation, Morning Has Broken. Please stand as you are willing and able.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world. Sweet the rains new fall, sunlit from heaven, like the first dew fall on the first grass. Praise for the sweetness of the red garden, sprung in completeness where his feet. Mine is the sunlight, mine is the morning, born of the one light, Eden saw play. Praise with elation, praise every morning, God's recreation of the new day. Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from the world.
Okay, Anne, moment for all ages. You're in for a treat. Wish I had known about this.
Too, but you're more than welcome to stay where you are if you prefer. And I'm going to ask people to stand up if they wish, or you can remain seated. And we're going to do a guided meditation called Inhaling the Universe. Okay. Start with
Logan, you want to come up with your brother? Nothing like putting you on the spot.
He doesn't have to. That's fine. Stand with your feet wide apart. You can do it seated too. Lift up your toes. You're going to have to stand up, I'm afraid, here. Lift up your toes and put them back down. And do that again. Lift your toes and put them back down and really feel the ground beneath your feet. Then raise your arms up as high as you can. Fingers apart. Wave them around. Breathe in deeply and hold your breath. Then put your arms down and breathe out. Uh-oh, I forgot, you can't hear me. Put your arms down and breathe out. Then raise your arms up again and grab the universe, the stars, the planets, everything in the solar system. And then enjoy it, shake it around, sprinkle it on yourself. And then we're gonna do that two more times. So take a deep breath and lower it down. When you come up, grab the universe, the stars, the planets, the solar system, and sprinkle yourself with it. Do it again. Sprinkle, sprinkle, sprinkle. And then you can put your arms down and take three deep breaths to calm. You can sit down to do that. Okay, remember, you are an important part of the universe. Thank you.
Sound like my yoga teacher. Very good. I loved it. Our speaker this morning, Michelle Franzl, hails from many worlds. She is the Frank B. Mallory Professor of Chemistry at Bryn Mawr College. As a quantum chemist, she has received many illustrious awards, and on her website, she wrote that she studies molecules with weird shapes. She also is an adjunct scholar of the Vatican Observatory, which I had to look up, which is an astronomical research and educational institution supported by the Roman Catholic Church. She's married to Victor Donet, who's a professor of mathematics at Bryn Mawr College, and they have two sons in their 20s. So where these worlds overlap, science, religion, spirituality, and living life as a teacher, mother, and wife, she publishes, talks, blogs, and gives workshops. When I was at Bryn Mawr College, many times a student, you'd be helping a student, and then just out of the blue, they'd talk about another math, a professor, you always a math professor, except for one time. This student raved about Michelle, how smart she was, what a great teacher she was, how helpful she was, and that she was a kind, caring person. So an accolade like that, especially from a stressed out achieving student, eclipses all awards and achievements. So thank you, Michelle, you're on.
Now I can see everybody. So I'm going to say that I love the De Colores as the introduction, because when I go to the Vatican Observatory, which is in outside of Rome up in the hills, and it's on the Papal Gardens, the Papal Summer Palace, and there's a working farm there now because Pope Francis is interested in sustainability. So my memory of when I think about going to the observatory, what I hear are the crowing of the chickens. The roosters go all day long and half the night, it seems, sometimes. So I want to thank you all for the invitation to be here. I really appreciate the chance to think with other people about the world. We inhale the universe all the time. We are stardust. Everything we touch was made like 13 billion years ago. Like if you look down into your cup of coffee, the protons in the water and in the oxygen, those were made 13 billion years ago, about 1 second after the universe was hatched. And I just find that a stunning thing to think about. So if you want, just think about that and drift along. Okay. So as Gina said, I'm a scientist and a Christian. I'm a practicing Roman Catholic. I'm also a contemplative, so I'm someone who appreciates the quiet and time away from sort of the hustle and bustle of things. I've spent time in monasteries. I did a 30-day retreat in silence. where you don't really talk to anyone for a month. And I'm interested in not just the interior life of myself, but also the interior life of molecules. I like to know what makes molecules tick. So if I can have the next slide, please. So I'm a quantum mechanic. I don't fix broken quantums, but I do get underneath molecules and see what makes them work. But I'm also interested in these sort of quiet and contemplative places. And I'm interested in where these things cross. What is it that you might have to say to a scientist about the contemplative life? And what might a scientist have to say to a monk about the contemplative life? So next slide, please. So my colleagues will laugh because I don't actually do anything in the laboratory. This is me in the teaching laboratory. And I'm pouring liquid nitrogen. But scientists, like poets, are digging into the universe. We're trying to wrap words and equations around things that are infinite and perhaps really at some level not knowable. So I think that this advice from the poet Wendell Berry might be apt for us as well. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. Our labs are sacred places. Look out the windows. There is a sacred place. Our churches are sacred places. Our dinner tables with each other are sacred places. I saw my brother for the first time in 4 years yesterday, and we shared a meal. And that was a truly sacred place and sacred moment. My sister made my tea this morning. I haven't seen her in 2 years. And that was a sacred moment. We are sacred to each other. Next slide, please. So I'd like us to think about that it's not just scientists, right? Poets and philosophers, we all have something to say, and we all have a stake in this common home. So this is a quote from Pope Francis. Prejudice should not have us criticize those who seek ecstasy in music or poetry. There is a subtle mystery in each of the movements and sounds of the world. And that's what I'm interested in thinking about. What are the subtle mysteries that we're paying attention to as we walk through this world? So the next slide, please. So I want to say that this is sort of practical advice from the impractical, right? We tend to think a little bit about monks and mystics and people who find their way away from the world to somehow be impractical. And science can be so practical, right? All of the things that are letting us see the slides up here, that let us get here today, you know, science and technology brought us things that make our lives easier, and very practical. So what do the practical and impractical have to say to each other? Next slide, please. So there's a lovely study that says that spoilers are a good thing. You know, we try to say, oh, don't spoil the thing. But it turns out that people enjoy a movie or a book better if they know the ending. So I'm going to tell you the ending right now. So you can enjoy this talk more. So what do mystics have to offer scientists? And I'm going to say that I want to use a definition of contemplation, which comes from Walter Burkhardt, that contemplation is a long, loving look at the real. And of course, science is a long, loving look at the real, right? Scientists are very passionate about what they study. They will spend years on some small little thing. I've spent years thinking about, you know, like a dozen different molecules. We're interested in taking a long, passionate, loving look at what's right in front of us. And contemplatives too. So we're already finding some common ground that we sit on, but if we're not aware of it, maybe we won't get as much out of it. So the advice that I would say a monk might have to offer a scientist is, first of all, an awareness of the multiple dimensions in which we live. The second is a non-judgmental view. And the third is an unforced pace. And I'll talk about each of these in turn. The photo is from a hermitage in the mountains of Japan, where Nakamura-san lives. He was a scientist who has since retreated to live up in the hills. This is a stove he built with his own hands. Again, a meshing of technology and contemplation. And he's making tea, which by now you might realize is something, it's my favorite beverage. So what about this comfort with multiple readings? Chemist and philosopher Michael Pagani summed up the mystery. We know more than we can say. Psychologist William James talked about walking this subtle edge between theology and science. What's ineffable, what's indescribable, and what we want to try to wrap our minds around. So what can scientists learn from contemplatives who open themselves up to the mystical, the unknowable, or at least the indescribable? And I think it's first that science needs to recognize that there's more to a phenomenon that we observe than we can quantify, right? We certainly can measure things, science measures things, but there's more to an experience than what we can measure. And that science is a portal into things that we cannot see or touch, and which we often lack the words to describe. And I'm going to say that science has gotten really bad with this. We've really stripped ourselves of the descriptive words. One of my colleagues pushes her students to like describe the colors of the compounds they make. If you look in papers in the literature from 100 years ago, chemists described what the smell of their compounds were. They would be making a reaction, and they would say an intermediate smelled of a wet dog fur, right? If you ever smell wet dog fur, it's pretty memorable, right? Or there's a whiff of ammonia at this point, you know you're on the right track. And then scientists began to understand how we smell. You smell because things go into your nose, like you're really being insinuated by these molecules, right? You are being invaded by these molecules, and now we don't want anything to do with it, right? We definitely don't want to be smelling things. And we don't even want to talk about it. So there's a paper about designing a molecule to use in perfumes. And so they're designing a molecule to smell. There is no mention in the paper of the smell of the molecule. There is 120 pages of extra material that they published along with it. On page 96 of these 120 pages, there they talk about the smell of the molecule. So we've like tried to banish this from the scientific literature, these kind of subjective senses, but there is more to it than we can actually measure. How do you measure a smell, right? How do you measure the smell of wet dog fur? I don't know, but scientists need to stop and smell the flowers, or perhaps their molecules, and recognize that there's multiple ways to read these things. So next slide, please. And there's a beautiful poem by the poet Marilyn Nelson, who was the poet laureate of Connecticut. And it's about dusting. And she says, "Thank you for these tiny particles of ocean salt, pearl necklace viruses, winged protozoans, for the infinite, intricate shapes of submicroscopic living things." And I came back from sabbatical a few years ago, and my office was dusty because I hadn't been in it in 6 months. And I started dusting it, and then I started thinking about this poem. And I went and found the book on my shelf, and I pulled it off to think about what was I dusting off. Like, I had been to the Vatican Observatory. There's a big meteorite collection there. I'd handled that. I'd been in Ireland and hiking the cliffs there, where the salt blows up from the water until you can't see a thing out of your glasses. And here I was realizing all this stuff is on my desk, and I'm dusting it away. Can I have the next slide, please? So what is it that scientists can think if they imagine what's in the dust, if the poetry can help them imagine what's in the dust? So this is from John Larsson, who's a Norwegian jazz musician, but who got interested in meteorites and stardust, inhaling the universe. And these are pictures of microscopic meteorites that are found on the roofs of buildings in Oslo. Are they not beautiful? These things are on the roof of your building. They are on the roof of my house. They're settled all over. If you pick them up, you can look at them under a microscope and you can see them. You can see where they've been ablated coming into our atmosphere. We're seeing something that's come to us from outer space. And it's just crumbs of the infinite are lying everywhere. And do we have the eyes to see them? He has a whole book. I mean, this is just one page. It's an amazing book. I highly recommend. Next slide, please. So when we're thinking about approaching science and about thinking about how to read the world around us, surely we can read it with equations, but also surely we can read the beauty in it. Karl Rahner was a well-known theologian and philosopher. He's considered to be by many Catholics to be sort of like, his theology is so high that nobody can really understand it. But when he, so you mentioned Rahner in a Catholic audience, they're like, whoa, no. But if you read Rahner's reflections on daily life, they're beautiful. There's none of that highfalutin theological language. And I love this particular quote. If there's any path on which I can approach you, it must lead through the middle of my very ordinary daily life. If we're looking for the sacred, we don't need to go looking somewhere else. We're sitting among it. It's right here in the lives we live. How can we find this? So next slide, please. So the next piece I want to talk about is this non-judgmental consideration of the details. Simone Weil said, attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. We can simply see. So this is the old telescope at Georgetown. Next slide, please. So Robert Boyle was sort of the original chemist. He wrote a book about sort of moving from alchemy into chemistry. He was part of founding the Royal Society. And he first thought that rather than publish scientific papers, you should really gather everybody and repeat your experiments for everyone to watch. And so, and then that of course immediately proves impractical, right? You know, people are not going to come, you know, every week to watch everyone do their experiments. And so he said reluctantly, okay, we can write to each other about these things, we can publish papers, but if you do it, you have to describe it so that people think they're actually there. And he was pushing this attention to detail, even the details you think might not matter. And so you get these vivid descriptions and you get these beautiful woodcuts that illustrate the scientific papers. And as abstract as scientific work is, we experience it first as something concrete, something particular, right? I see something and I say, huh, that's funny. Here's this molecule with this weird shape. Why is it misbehaving? And of course, the molecule is not misbehaving. It's doing what the molecule wants to do, but the chemist thinks it's misbehaving. So you have to be able to see without judgment. I can't really say that molecule is doing something wrong. I have to say molecule is doing something. What is it doing? So it involves a training to think about seeing what's in front of you without judging it. And St. Ignatius of Loyola talked about this sort of composition of place. And again, if you're placing yourself within the sacred, to consider the details, even the details you think are not important. So often, you know, we engage with the sacred and we want to say, I'm a theist, so I would say, you know, I want to talk about God, and here's, you know, God, and we imagine like the roof of the Sistine Chapel, right, the big can coming out and, you know, life coming into to Adam. But in fact, Ignatius is saying, you know, sit there and put yourself into the scene, smell the dust, hear the noise, think about these things that are the ordinary parts of life. This is how we experience these things non-judgmentally. So these are some things that scientists can certainly learn from all these practices, whether it's Buddhist practice, Hindu practice, Christian practice, Catholic practice. Many practices of the sacred have you thinking about the things that surround you non-judgmentally. Next slide, please. So if you find that Simone Weil and Robert Boyle are perhaps not to your taste, I love poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti's description of this. This is from a book, Poetry as Insurgent Art, which is just a bunch of little pieces of advice to poets. And I give this advice to my science students who just lose it entirely because, of course, you know, I would never use any word like that. If you would be a poet or a scientist, write living newspapers, be a reporter from outer space, filing dispatches to some supreme managing editor who believes in full disclosure and has a low tolerance for bullshit. Amen. Amen, indeed. I mean, that's what I strive for when I write, no matter what I'm writing and where. Next slide, please. I also like to point out there's a moral dimension to these things. Pope Francis in Laudato Si talks about it's not just satisfying our curiosity about the world, but that this must go then into play with the people that we live with, that we're called to a painful awareness of what's happening in the world around us. If you've read Robert Heinlein, he talks about the fair witnesses, who will look at a house, and if you say, what color is the house? They say, this side of the house is white. They're not willing to admit to anything beyond what they can actually see. But the seeing leads us, or should lead us, to a direction and should lead us to action. And that's perhaps the other piece that scientists can learn from contemplatives, is that it's not enough just to see, it's what do we do with what we see. So next slide, please. The last thing I think, and this is perhaps the most important thing that scientists can get from contemplatives, is the notion of an unforced pace. So my son is a graduate student in mathematics, and he came home for spring break, and he said to me, one of my colleagues said, I wish math graduate school were more monastic. And I said, well, what does he mean by that? And he says, we would do math all the time, only math, thinking only math, doing only math. I said, do you know what a monastic life actually looks like? And he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, every day monastics have an hour of recreation. And there's times of meditation, and everyone has kitchen duty except for the abbot. And so monastic life is not this sort of total immersion in one thing. It's an unforced pace and cycle of life. And if I can have the next slide, please. And I love this sort of quote from Thomas Merton, who talks about the rush and the pace of life, and how this is a form of violence against the world. That if we're not willing to sit with the world as it is, if we're not willing to do it slowly at an unforced pace, we're in fact doing violence to the world. And I think that scientists tends towards the fast and the frantic. American Chemical Society now has a journal, it's called ASAP, as soon as possible. And they promise that if you get the paper accepted, it will be online and available in under 24 hours. I'm like, does it have to be this fast? And it's not clear that fast pace is actually productive of good science. So I want to tell you a story. It's a Philadelphia story. We're going to have the next slide, please. And here I'm going to ask a question, so there's audience participation. Tell me what these figures are doing, if you can see. It's a little light, but what are they doing? Oh, you're all too good. Are they on their phones? They're all texting, right? Because, of course, I see this, if I look out at my students, they're all bent over like this texting, or they're sitting in the hallway outside of class and they look exactly like this and they're all on their phones. It's from the Metropolitan Museum, and definitely they are, in fact, I think, meditating and praying. But I think when I see this, I think that they are on their phones. But contemporary monastics and people who pray know how to wait. They don't need to pull their phone out. If you've seen the movie Into Great Silence, which is a year in a Carthusian monastery, it's got no soundtrack other than the monastery itself. And when they first wrote to the abbot asking if they could come make this film, he wrote in 1984, and it took them 16 years to respond. And then they said, yes, you can come. And they had to think about it, right? It's an unforced pace. So if I could have the next slide, please. So this is the very first x-ray, it said, that was taken. It's of William Roentgen's wife's hand. That's a ring on the hand. She was very creeped out by this picture, I'm going to say. And this was in early November of 1895. And he was experimenting with these things called Crookes tubes. And I'll show you a picture. And he realized when he had a screen up that when he moved his hand in front of the screen, he could see through his hand and he could see the bones in his hands. And this was an incredible revelation. He spent about a week playing with it. When he revealed it and he went to give a talk and revealed what he'd figured out, this revolutionized medicine in very short order. I mean, doctors realized they could see broken bones. There was all sorts of things. So it quickly sped through the world, and it was on the front pages of all kinds of papers. If I can have the next slide. So these are Crookes tubes. So you can see on the one side that it's just like, looks like white alabaster or something like that, carved flowers. If you shine x-rays on them, you can get them to fluoresce like this and make these beautiful colors. And people had these in their homes. They were like, you know, cute toys. They're letting out x-rays, I'm going to say. And people were not shielding them, so they were just like x-rays everywhere. I know, we think about this now. So in 1890, about 5 years before Röntgen was doing his experiments, there were two physicists at University of Pennsylvania, in our own Philadelphia, Arthur Goodspeed, I'm really not making that name up either, I promise, and William Jennings, who's not the William Jennings you're thinking about, and they were doing demonstrations with Crookes tubes. And at the end of the night, one of them had brought a bunch of photographic plates because they were trying to take pictures of what they were doing, and he had a stack of photographic plates, and he put his unused trolley fare on top. And then Godspeed offered him a chance to look at the Crookes tubes up close, and he's like, sure. So they turned on the Crookes tubes, looked at everything, and then finished packing up and went home. Next slide, please. And when Jennings developed the photographic plates, some of them had these weird images on them, these disks and these funny kind of scattered particles, and he didn't know what they were. And so they started, this is the days before the internet and really the days before the telephone, they telegraphed each other. There were telegrams back and forth. They spent 3 days telegraphing each other back and forth, trying to figure out what happened, but they never could understand what happened. Next slide, please. 5 years later, when they saw this picture on the front page of the paper in Philadelphia, they knew what they'd done. They had had the first x-ray 5 years before. But because they weren't willing to slow down and think about it, they missed it. An unforced pace led to the failure to see what was right in front of them. So Annie Dillard has this great quote about writing, but it also applies to science. Out of a human population on Earth of 4.5 billion, perhaps 20 people can write a serious book in a year. I'm in the middle of writing a book. It's taking me a year. She's totally right. Some people lift cars. Some people enter week-long sled races, go over Niagara Falls in barrels, fly planes through the Arc de Triomphe. There is no call to take human extremes as norms. And something I tell my students pretty often. So I want to flip this around to finish this talk and to say that contemplatives also have something they can learn from scientists. Next slide, please. So that's me, the scientist, next to the Buddhist abbot in Kyoto, and we are both meditating. I will also point out it is 90 degrees and the humidity is 95%. That was a real experience. Next slide, please. So again, here's the take-home message, so spoilers. What is it that contemplatives can learn from scientists? First of all, the gift of beauty in the strange and the unexpected. That doubt is not the enemy, and an ability to live with uncertainty. Next slide, please. So this is from the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Edward Purcell's description. This is from his Nobel Prize address. He won it for the physics that underlies NMR and MRI. So if you've ever had an MRI, this is the physics that's involved. There's a little, you know, it's way too small to read, and that's intentional. But when he talks about it, he says, I've not yet lost a feeling of wonder and of delight that this delicate motion should reside in all the ordinary things around us. Every proton does it, and it does it in a magnetic field, and we are all sitting in the magnetic field of the Earth. I remember in the winter of our first experiments, looking on snow with new eyes. There the snow lay around my doorstep, great heaps of protons processing in the Earth's magnetic field. To see the world for a moment as something rich and strange is the private reward of many a discovery. So this ability to see the rich and the strange, even in something like physics, is, I think, a gift from the scientists to the contemplatives. Next slide, please. This is from an essay I wrote about beautiful molecules. And when I submitted it, I had a list of my molecules. They made this figure of them and then titled it Michelle's. I love the fact that it's not, you know, Francel's. It's Michelle's top 10 most beautiful molecules. Penicillin is up there. Caffeine is up there. alcohol is up there. Vanilla is up there, the scent of vanilla. Insulin is up there. Azulene is up there, which is a beautiful blue molecule, surprising to chemists that it's blue. But it was a whole essay about the beauty in these molecules. So an ability to find beauty in the strange. If you talk to Buddhist monks about this, you know, they'll talk about looking at a pile of dirt and being able to see the beauty in the destruction of something. So this notion that we can find beauty in the strange. Next slide, please. Doubt and mystery. What we don't know drives us, right? It's what draws a scientist in. It is not to us a bug, but a feature, right? Next slide, please. This is my boss at the observatory, Brother Guy Consolmagno. He's studies meteorites. He was on the group that decided that Pluto wasn't a planet. My son has yet to forgive him for that. But he talks about this question when you're trying to think about doubt and mystery. Is there enough money in your pocket for a gelato? And that is an uninteresting question in some ways, because the answer is either yes or no. It doesn't generate any other question. Either there's €2 in your pocket and you can walk down the street and get a gelato, which Guy will do with you anytime. And I will do it too. Right, you just walk right out the gates of the Papal Gardens and there's gelato right down the street. But that's an uninteresting question. Next slide, please. It's more the questions that when something looks funny that draw us to think more deeply. This is the hands of my niece. I was visiting them in California, and my niece comes in and she says, there's something wrong with the sun. There is something funny with the sun. And I'm like, really? She says, it's wrong. The light is wrong. And I began to worry that there was a fire, and that she was seeing the smoke covering the thing. And of course, there's only one road out from my parents' house. And I'm like, there's a fire, we need to get out now. So I go out to look, and she's right, the light is funny, but there's no smoke. And I realized when I looked down at the leaves, the shadows of the leaves, they all were doubled. And I thought, oh my gosh, we're having an eclipse. And I am like, how did I not know they were having an eclipse? Well, the eclipse was not happening in Pennsylvania, so it was not in the news here. And my parents live in a very rural area, and they don't really follow the news either. So none of us knew there was going to be an eclipse. But the notion that, you know, what is funny about this, and how is that happening? That's the kind of question that draws us in as scientists. And sometimes people of faith get really bent out of shape about doubt, that somehow it's a bad thing. But I would say this doubt is what draws us into the mystery, to just keep asking the question. What's so strange about this? What's so beautiful about this? So next slide, please. So there's Paul Tillich is a theologian, a Protestant theologian, and his notion, which I often tell students, is doubt is not the opposite of faith. It is one element of faith. But if we don't have doubt, there's a lot that we're missing. So next slide, please. The last bit I want to talk about is uncertainty. Henry Nouwen, who was a Catholic priest who founded a movement, was part of a movement to have people live with people who are experiencing many limitations, he said, not everything is knowable. And he talked about people want to be competent in God. They would like to say, I know God, I got it, right? But you cannot be competent in the divine, right? It is ineffable, it is beyond, what's ever beyond us. How can we think we can be competent in it? Next slide, please. Scientists get this. If you know the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, this is a joke about it. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle, for those who don't know, says that the closer you can locate a particle, the less you know about which direction it's moving in. And so if you if you know too much about the momentum, the direction they're moving, you don't know where your keys are. And my husband isn't here, so I won't say anything about lost keys and how we find them. But at some point, it is just not knowable. You cannot build a better device to figure it out. You have to live with this uncertainty. And it's not just in position and velocity direction. There's all sorts of these so-called conjugate pairs in quantum mechanics. that are like this, where you can only know so much. And I can't prove to you with physics the existence of God or the lack of existence of God. You get to some point where things are unknowable, and you simply must make a decision about what framework do you want to use to move through the world. And no one's ever held a Higgs boson in their hand, but its tracks convince some people that it exists. And some people look around the world and see tracks of the divine and say that God exists. I'll go back to Michael Pugliani in this and say, we know more than we can say. And I think we do know more than we can say, and there is more around us than we can detect. So next slide, please. This is Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, which is a beautiful, beautiful space where math and physics and the sacred meet. My husband, the mathematician, who is not Catholic, was raised in a Unitarian church, and we went to see this cathedral, and I thought we were going to have to peel him out and drag him off. The mix of the math and the mystic was to him incredibly powerful. Theological formation is a gradual and often painful discovery of God's incomprehensibility. You can be competent in many things, but you cannot be competent in God. Next slide, please. I want to end with this snippet of poetry from John O'Donohue, who is an Irish priest who lived on the cliffs in Ireland, who died young and tragically. But I love this last little bit. It's from his poem, Matins. Somewhere out at the edges, the night is turning, and the waves of darkness begin to brighten the shore of dawn. The heavy dark falls back to earth, and the freed air goes wild with light. The heart fills with fresh, bright breath, and thoughts stir to give birth to color. De colores. Next slide, please. So I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Bryn Mawr, which has supported me as a faculty member all these years, the Center for the Contemplative Mind and Society, which thinks about many of these issues where faith and the practice of our scholarly work crisscross. The Vatican Observatory, which is filled with delightful physicists who really do think hard and delightfully about the world. The NSF, the Clouds Fund, which have funded me, and various people who've helped along the way. And thank you. And I'm going to do one more slide, last slide. And the last slide, this is the back wall of the Abbey Church in Collegeville in Minnesota. And the abbot is a chemist, and when chemists look at a bunch of hexagons, we think graphite, and the designers thought beehive. But I wonder what the abbot thinks when he sits in the front, and this is his view of all these hexagons. Thank you.
Thank you. Sort of speechless. Other than I want to go back to grad school and study under you, Michelle. Sorry, Victor. Okay, time for our Matters of the Heart. John will introduce. It'll be a time to briefly share a joy or concern, and we'll have a little musical interlude, and after that, John will take over.
Okay, we're going to have a short musical interlude here while you gather your thoughts, and then if you would like to share, we have people here in the sanctuary and people on Zoom. So we're going to start with those here in the sanctuary. If you would go up to the microphone to the other side of the dais up there, one at a time, and share after our musical interlude is completed. And then once those in the sanctuary have shared, then we will provide additional instructions for those on Zoom and how they can participate. Okay, if anybody here in the sanctuary would care to share a joy that's lifting them up or a sorrow that's weighing them down with our community.
Okay, this morning we're singing something a little different. Some of you might recognize the tune. The lyrics will be on the screen. There's not a title, but the first line is, "From all that dwell below the skies." Please let us join together and sing our closing hymn. Wait, now my senses. Stand as you are willing and able.